You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies for a slight delay. We took the usual license. Call it academic, call it master license, call it whatever you like. Thank you for having accepted that invitation, and I'm absolutely sure you will not regret it, because today we have a wonderful speaker. He comes from our Brussels office, sister office, Carnegie Europe. Sunad Rugen is a visiting scholar with Carnegie Europe, and he is much more than that. He is one of the foremost Turkish analysts and thinkers on a wide variety of issues, from foreign policy to economic policy to domestic politics in Turkey. He is the founding partner of Istanbul Economics, which is a Turkish consultancy firm that specializes in public and regulatory issues. And he is chairman of the Center for Economic and Foreign Policy Studies, which has a nice acronym of EDAM, which is an independent think tank in Istanbul. Sinan Ulgen, before he became one of us, i.e. A political scientist, political analyst, he spent time with the Turkish Foreign Service. He served his country at the United Nations. At the United Nations desk in Ankara. He also served at the Turkish permanent delegation to the European Union in Brussels. And very interestingly, he served at the Turkish embassy in Tripoli, Libya, which was 15 years ago. Sinan is a regular contributor. You must have come across his name in a number of leading international publications, from the International Herald Tribune to the Wall Street Journal to Le Figaro and some others. He is an author of many things and many books and studies. What you have out there on the small table is his recent Carnegie paper, A Place in the Sun of 15 Minutes of Fame, which we have translated into Russian for your benefit. But there's also an original English copy, which can be downloaded from the Carnegie website. So without further ado, let me pass the floor to Sinan, who will talk exactly about that, Turkish foreign policy. What is it? Where it's headed? How should one feel? Come
on. Dimitri, really, many, many thanks. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. Many thanks for organizing this. Incidentally, this is my first trip to Moscow. So this really doubles the pleasure, but I also want to thank you for being responsible for another first in my concerning my life, in a way. My first, at least translated, copy of a Russian piece, or a piece in Russian, on Turkish foreign policy. So it's really very much appreciated. Now, when I first talked to Dimitri about this trip to Moscow, the idea was to present this paper that Carnegie Europe had published and which I had drafted a couple of months ago, entitled 15 Minutes of Fame, or Place in the Sun of 15 Minutes of Fame, which essentially is trying to look not so much at what is happening in Turkish foreign policy, which I'll also be glad to discuss with you, but really take you behind the scenes and explain the drivers of what's happening in Turkish foreign policy. And once we talk about that, then I'll go, you know, in front of the scene and look at what the impact of those changes has been, in particular Turkey's relations with its own neighborhood, Russia, but also the US, the EU, and in general the regional system. So let me first start by telling you the three drivers that I have identified, which are, to me at least, at the root of the changes that we see, the transformation that we see in Turkish foreign policy. The first one is a difficult word every time I have a trouble. It's called the reconceptualization of Turkish identity and Turkish foreign policy. Now, what I mean here is essentially the following. For a very long time, Turkish foreign policy had a very well-defined anchor, direction, objective, which was to be fully in line with the West. Of course, there were a number of external factors, like before 1989, obviously the fact that Turkey was part of the Western camp, a member of NATO, and so on. But fundamentally, Turkish strategic thinking about foreign policy was about, well, let's really not find ourselves in a situation where we would be incompatible with the thinking in the West. So let's follow that line, let's follow that trend. That has changed. That has changed essentially because now there is what I call this reconceptualization of Turkish foreign policy, which is linked to reconceptualization of Turkish identity. When you read, for instance, our foreign minister Davutoğlu's book, or if you have a chance to read it, it's very clear from his writings. What he says, in essence, and he's somebody who's been quite instrumental in this transformation of Turkish foreign policy, is that Turkey is a country with a multitude of identities. So, yes, Turkey's Western identity is important. It's not something that he denies. But nonetheless, it's not only about that. Turkey has a multitude of identities. It has the Western identity, but it also has the Islamic identity. It has, although when you talk to him, he wouldn't accept this, but nonetheless, from what is out there, you can interpret that, you know, Turkey has this Ottoman legacy and Ottoman identity. So his policy advice for the transformation of Turkish foreign policy is Turkey should be aware of this multitude of identities and implement a foreign policy that does not favor a relationship over the other, which is a fundamental rethink. Because for a very long time, as I've tried to set out, the primary driver of Turkish foreign policy was to be in full compliance, full compatibility with the West. Now that has changed. As long as this decision that Turkey should not favor one relationship over the other, which opens a very different approach. And here there's also the relationship with Russia that comes into play. Because once you opine that the relationship with the West is not that sacrosanct anymore, and it is not in current Turkish foreign policy thinking, then obviously as policy makers you obtain a much larger freedom of action and maneuver. And that's essentially what's been happening in Turkish foreign policy. That Turkey is now intent on establishing solid relations with a number of its neighbors, including Russia, including Turkey's neighbors in the Middle East, in contrast to perhaps a lack of such efforts in the near past. A second element that tends to give strength to this dynamic is the belief that with the end of the Cold War and with what's happening in our region, particularly in the Middle East, after the US intervention in Iraq, is that Turkey is not anymore a country at the periphery of Europe. On the contrary, Turkey is a pivotal state, an emerging regional power that should act much more proactively in this region in trying to bring forth peace, stability, prosperity, but nonetheless all of this which militate for a much more active and even some say assertive foreign policy. That is really the second dynamic that tends to strengthen this primary objective. And the third dynamic there, under the same chapter in a way, is really this growing frustration with Europe. When I'm known to be one of the now endangered species in Turkey among the pro-European people. So I invited to give talks in not in similar circumstances so much, but also to the youth, the universities, and so on. And you can't believe the degree of acrimony today in the Turkish public opinion about Europe. The belief that no matter what we do, the EU will never say yes to Turkey. So why bother? And this thinking has actually impregnated not only youth, not only people who, you know, just read the news and so on, but also the policy circles, people in government, people within the ruling party. So today, the EU objective remains one of the primary objectives of Turkish policy, no doubt about that. But the energy that's put behind that objective, the momentum which both sides had actually created up until a few years ago has totally disappeared, evaporated. So this really is the third dimension, in a way, which tends to complete this picture of let's shape Turkey into a regional power that can act independently, if the need be, on issues where it believes its national interest is served better. For instance, the relationship with Iran, to me, is a particularly good example to illustrate this phenomenon, where Turkey took a position which was unimaginable a few years ago, to be an outlier in this Western Club of Nations as a NATO member in trying to bring forth a negotiated settlement with Iran on a case where the P5 plus one and in particular Washington reacted very heavily. So this is a bit emblematic of this new assertiveness, confidence of Turkish foreign policy, which are, by the way, undergird by two other dynamics, which the second one is what I've called in this paper, I don't know how you translated that one, Dimitri, the desecuritization of Turkish foreign policy. Now, again, when we look back at the traditional practice of Turkish foreign policy, the security aspect was very strong. I can even possibly claim that foreign policy was subservient to security policy. That the foreign policy's primary objective was to ensure Turkey's national security, territorial integrity, and so on. That was really the primary outlook of Turkish foreign policy. Now, that has changed drastically. I can, you know, say with a degree of certainty that today Turkish diplomats do not have the single mandate of furthering security policy, but they have a much wider mandate in trying to bring forth economic prosperity, investments, trade, try to grow Turkey's soft power in a way. So this has become a much more complicated picture than the more perhaps simple aspect of a security-conscious, a security-focused foreign policy which used to be the Turkish direction in years past. And here my question is, you know, whether we have taken this trend a bit too far. Again, when we look at the question of missile defense, for instance, there, Turkey's stance going to the NATO summit in Lisbon was that the countries which were identified by the other NATO members as potential threats to justify the missile defense initiative, and here we're talking about Syria, we're talking about Iran, were countries that did not figure among the threats from the perspective of Turkish policymakers. So the question is whether this desecuritization aspect of Turkish policy has been taken too far and therefore will drive a wedge between Turkey and its allies within NATO in the years to come. The third aspect that strengthened this phenomenon is the transformation of Turkey into a trading state. And here, what I mean is the growth of economics as a driver of foreign policy. Now, in my previous life, Dimitri mentioned that I served a number of years in the Turkish Foreign Service. And for us at the time, and there are people in this room who can substantiate this claim, for us at that time, talking about economics, trying to help business ties, visiting companies, helping Turkish companies capture market share in foreign markets was beneath us. That's not what a diplomat used to do. We like to do the international relations part, the political part, and so on. But the economic part, the business ties, that wasn't our job. That was the job of the businessmen, that was the job of the company representatives, you know, the foreign trade people, and so on, but not our job. Now, that has vastly changed. Today, you know, Turkish diplomats are judged also by their effectiveness in how much they help Turkish companies. So this trend is certainly underpinned by the fact that Turkey has a growing economy. Today, Turkey reached the $800 billion mark. It's the 16th largest economy in the world. Quite a diversified economy from that perspective. A trade volume of $350 billion, which at the end of the day led to the emergence of a political constituency in Turkey that is interested in export markets. And therefore, this democratic pressure on the government to establish stable ties and to use Turkish diplomacy as an entry point in order to tap external markets, to boost Turkey's exports, to win public contracts, has become a defining feature of modern-day Turkish diplomacy. And from this perspective, today Turkey is much closer to the type of more economically driven diplomacies that we have seen in Western Europe, for instance. So these are really, for me at least, the three main drivers in trying to understand the shape, the transformation of Turkish foreign policy. Now, the second aspect that I wanted to touch upon is essentially how sustainable that this transformation is, which is, by the way, you know, reflects a bit of my the reason why I chose this title to put this question out there. How sustainable that is? Is this going to be, as Andy Warhol claimed, just 15 minutes of fame, or more like a place in the sun? So whether this assertiveness, this ambition that we have seen, this streak of independent thinking, in a way, that we have seen in Turkish foreign policy, is something structural, or is it something more conjectural, due either to the ruling party in Turkey or to the changing circumstances in the region? My answer to that is that, by and large, this is a structural phenomenon, and there is no going back. So we're not going to see, whatever happens, the type of Turkish diplomacy of 10 years ago. This is done. So the assertiveness, the ambition, the multilateral thinking that we see today in Turkish foreign policy is here to stay. This is going to be the shape of things to come. And the reason why I say this is essentially when we look at the rhetoric, this rhetoric of having good relations with the neighborhood, having a more influential foreign policy, is actually not a new rhetoric. It is not this ruling party that adopted this rhetoric. We can trace it back to the 1980s with President Özal, who talked about similar things. Then in the 1990s, the Foreign Minister İsmail Cem had again a very similar rhetoric. But the difference between those two periods is that at that time, Turkey did not have the means to implement this foreign policy. Today it has. And it will continue to have. The reason being that Turkey's economic growth prospects are, according to many analysts, are decent, if not to say good. Last year, Turkey was the third in the world after China and Argentina with an 8.9% growth record. And so going forward, Turkey's average growth is likely to be around 4 or 5%, if not more. And what this does, it really enables the country to draw upon this growing economic might in order to underpin this more ambitious foreign policy. When I was presenting this paper in some of the European capitals, there, when I tried to paint this picture and tell this in so many words, and the example that I gave is that, last year Turkey opened 18 embassies worldwide. This is at a time when the EU countries are cutting down on their number of embassies because of austerity measures. They're cutting down on their foreign policy budget, if not to say the defense budget. So, from that perspective, Turkey stands in stark contrast to some of these dynamics that we see in Western Europe. And this is really my fundamental point in trying to assert that these changes that I'm trying to outline here are somewhat permanent changes. The second reason why I think these are some permanent changes is that today there are still a number of critics of Turkish foreign policy. The critics are on episodes such as relations with Iran, with Hamas, this perhaps undue attention to the Middle East, the fact that the momentum with Europe has been lost, the relationship with Washington has the tendency to turn sour, and so on and so forth. But fundamentally, from the Turkish population perspective, the current foreign policy is a very popular foreign policy. It is very popular because it is now becoming increasingly difficult in Turkey to champion an alternative narrative for foreign policy. The alternative narrative being, no, these are too risky. We should go back to the time when our priority should be to remain, not to remain at odds with the Western thinking, but to be a fully compatible partner in the Western Club of Nations. This narrative does not work in Turkey anymore. It does not work because of rising anti-Americanism. It does not work because of frustrations with the EU. And it does not work because the picture that's been painted by this transformed Turkish foreign policy appeals more, this picture of Turkey becoming a regional power, Turkey becoming a central state, appeals much more than the previous picture of Turkey being just a member of the Western Club of Nations. So for these reasons, I tend to think that indeed the transformation that we have seen is a permanent fixture of Turkish foreign policy. Now finally, what does this mean? for Turkey's relationship with its own neighborhood and Turkey's relationship with its traditional partners. When we talk about Europe and the US to some extent, the first consequence that I draw from this is that the asymmetry that existed between Ankara and Brussels, and you know, to a larger extent between Ankara and Washington, obviously, the power asymmetry is going to be eradicated. It is going to change. That is very visible in Ankara's relations with Brussels, for instance. Turkey does not want to see itself today solely as a candidate country negotiating for EU accession. It sees itself as beyond that. As a foreign policy actor that is on symmetric footing, by and large, with the EU. And that's the way it acts. That's the way it acts in the Middle East, in Northern Africa, and so on. Now, that will also mean that in areas where Turkey has disputes with the EU, whether it's on Cyprus, whether it's on the NATO-EU relationship, it is going to be more difficult to deal with this more assertive Turkey. So the power relationship, from Ankara's perspective, has fundamentally changed. Now, with the US also we see this sense that the power relationship has changed. Of course, this does not mean that, you know, Turkey is a global power, far from that. But it just means that in areas where US interests and Turkish interests overlap, the dialogue between Ankara and Washington will be more of a dialogue between equals. To the extent that, again, going back to the fundamental drivers that I've tried to portray, the security relationship, once we change the security relationship, once Turkey is not a fully dependent consumer of security, which at the end of the day is provided by the US, the power relationship with the US also has the capacity to change. Now, that is also why in a case like Iran, for instance, we can see Turkey taking the lead of trying to be a mediator despite what transpired to be US concerns about the role that Turkey has played in this. So this essentially means that we are seeing a fundamental structural change in the power relationship in the region. The new role that Turkey has adopted for itself and the implications of that new role are quite significant, quite critical. This is really the type of new Turkey that the region and the world will be accustomed to. Now, the relationship with Russia as well reflects this phenomenon. Today, across the board in Turkey, despite what the US may think, despite what Brussels may think, there is almost unanimous consent of improving the relationship with Russia. Now, you are better placed to tell me whether that is true also in Moscow and in Russia. But in Turkey, that is quite clear. Across the board, there is and we see this in actually many areas, be it cooperation in energy, in particular, you know, in nuclear energy. The fact that our policies on the Black Sea are pretty much in parallel. The two countries think that the Black Sea countries should own or should display ownership of the problems in the Black Sea and should develop the regional institutions to address those problems. and not necessarily invoke outside powers in this region. The concerns with regard to the Middle East are very much the same, whether they're on Iran or even on Libya. 2 days ago, the statements from Medvedev reflected very much also the Turkish thinking on Libya. So in many areas, the relationship with Russia has improved. And when you take into perspective what I've told you regarding the dynamics of Turkish foreign policy, I think that this improvement in the bilateral relationship between Turkey and Moscow is also a feature of the foreign policy of the new Turkey. And therefore, even going forward, this is the trend that we shall see in our bilateral relationship. So perhaps, Dimitri, if I would like to end here without monopolizing the time that's been allocated to me and answer some of the questions that you all may have.
Sinan, thank you so much. That was brilliant. Not only was it brilliant, it was extremely well-structured, extremely clear. And I think that this is a great foundation for a truly intimate interaction that is about to start right now. So please catch my eye, and I will give the floor, sir, in the back, followed by, yes, of course. If you could, first of all, state your name and affiliation, and then your answer or your comment.
Is it broken? Yes. My name is Sergey Utkin. I work at the Institute of World Economy and International Relations. Actually, I have plenty of questions to our guest, but I will choose just two. You have been speaking about this ever-growing consent towards constructive policy towards Russia in Turkey. And in this sense, you may probably know about the idea proposed by Medvedev and Merkel to create an EU-Russia committee on foreign and security policy. And the further idea offered by the European Council on Foreign Relations to make it not just EU-Russia committee, but EU-Russia-Turkey committee. Because Russia and Turkey are the two major foreign policy actors which are outside the EU and still somewhat close to the EU. Do you believe that this idea is somehow feasible or is it absolutely fantastic? And do you think that any kind of such trilateral cooperation is possible in the future? And the second question on the EU recession. You said that the majority of people now thinks that Turkey will not be allowed to join the EU in a foreseeable future, but many link this to regional development in Turkey. They say when we go to the capital, it's okay. When we speak to Turkish elites, they're absolutely European. We can get them to the EU today. But when we go to the regions, we see Asia inside. So do you believe that, to be quite honest, Turkey is ready or close to be ready to join the EU by the level of its development? Thank you.
Sinan, I would suggest that you take questions one by one, and then we'll see. At some point, we'll have to collect them, but initially, we'll just give every question a very decent and long answer.
Mark Leonard, who is the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations, asked me to write an opinion piece in reaction to their Multipolar Europe booklet. I refused. I refused essentially because I had nothing positive to say on this idea. And just to be kind to Mark, I think it's a fantasy. I don't see any sort of, concrete thing coming out of that proposal. Two reasons. One is that the trilateral structure, even if it's in the area of security, Turkey would be averse to that because even though there may be less support today for Turkey's EU accession, nonetheless, the Turkish government is very conscientious not to create alternative structures that may possibly be construed as an alternative to Turkey's full membership. And this is one of those. And secondly, again, you know, Turkey being a NATO member, it still values the transatlantic angle and this sort of, you know, European contingency would certainly not be very positively viewed in Washington. That is not to say that Turkey is not interested in security cooperation with the EU, and that is not to say that Turkey is not interested in security cooperation with Russia. On the contrary. But these are two bilateral tracks, and Turkey wants to maintain those as bilateral tracks. Whether Turkey is ready for the EU, I think Turkey is absolutely ready for the EU, especially when we look at the latest enlargement, Bulgaria, Romania, when we look at the problems that we now have in Hungary in terms of the democratic rights, especially the media rights. Turkey today is, you know, is a richer country, not only in terms of its GDP, but also per capita income from Bulgaria and Romania. So there is absolutely no economic rationale for keeping Turkey out. And I'm not even talking about the growth rates. The fundamental reason why today Turkey is out, yes, there are regional differences within Turkey between the West and the East. These are social differences, ethnical differences, cultural differences. That's all very well. But then, you know, Turkey was not in a different geography in 1963 when we concluded the association agreement. It was still in the same geography when Turkey was found to be eligible for membership in 1989, when Turkey started membership negotiations in 2004. So from that perspective, nothing's changed. So I think that here the hurdles are really political hurdles. These are just, you know, excuses in a way not to accept a country that certainly has the potential to change the internal balance of the EU. It's a big country with an 80 million population almost. So it is apt to change the political balances with the EU within the EU once it becomes a member. It will have the most seats in parliament, along with Germany, and so on and so forth. But also there is the religious cultural aspect. Turkey is a Muslim country. It's a secular state, but a Muslim country. And today, when you look at the political winds in Europe, they are not particularly propitious for the entry of a 80 million people strong Muslim country. So I think these are the fundamental reasons. It's not that Turkey is too poor or too big or too, but it's just that some people in Europe think that this is not a country that, either for political reasons or for religious reasons, should be an EU member.
Thank you, Victor. Can we have the mic? No, first on my left, and then. But anyway, since you.
He got the mic.
You can go second.
I'm sorry.
Nice. First of all, I'll thank you for the very provocative.
Could you.
Victor Kowalzin, Moscow State University, and Kabashev Foundation. First of all, I thank you for a very provocative and thoughtful presentation of your view. My question is, to what extent is this change, shift in Turkish position is the part more broad picture? I mean, resurrection of Asia versus West. Or, if you prefer, to what extent Turkey as a country is turning or returning to its Asian rule. To what extent your country begin to feel itself not only part of the Middle East area, it's obvious, but Asia as a more broad dynamic. Thank you.
I think there is a phenomenon of causality here. It's not because if there's a power shift, it's not because power is shifting from the West to the East that we have this resurgence of Turkey. But I think that the resurgence of Turkey as an emerging power is now used to illustrate this power shift as well. So for me, it's the reverse. It is because you now have countries like Turkey, Brazil, India, China, Russia, that have a more influential role on the global scene, Indonesia, on the global scene, that we can now talk about one of our friends called the Second World, these middle emerging powers. And Turkey is one of those. Now, whether the attention of policymakers is shifting towards Asia, no. But the attention of policymakers is certainly shifting on maintaining a web of balanced relationship with Turkey's neighbors, but also going beyond Turkey's neighbors. Here, incidentally, there was a quite interesting phenomenon about 4 months ago, where Turkey was host to military maneuvers where four Chinese jets, also fighters, participated. And that was a first, Turkey allowing Chinese fighters to take part in military maneuvers in Turkey. And on their way to Turkey, they had landed in Iran, which was also a first for Iran, allowing foreign fighter jets to land on their territory. But again, so this is just to illustrate that now this vision extends beyond, of course, just Brussels, and I'll try to set that out, but also beyond the neighborhood, and Turkey wants to play the global game to the best of its abilities, and that means engaging the remaining emerging powers and the global powers. Turkey is a G20 country like Russia, and Turkish diplomacy now has this volition to really engage the rest of the world. And by the way, it's not only about Asia, but when you look at what Turkey is doing, it's really about this global engagement with Africa as well, opening embassies there. Turkey is going to be hosting next month the summit of the less developed countries, which is a summit that takes place only once a decade. And there are many examples of that. So I think this is the reading that I have of Turkish foreign policy.
Thank you. Sir?
Hi, I'm Yair, and the Muslim correspondent of the Israeli Public Radio. And first of all, thank you for your work, it's fascinating. And my question is regarding the relation between Turkey and Israel. Because I think one of the areas where we can see very clearly the process that you just mentioned in Spain is the relation between these two countries. I think in the 90s it was a strategic partnership, very strong relations based on a lot of common interests. And I think in the last few years, we can see very clearly how the relations became very different. And my question is, whether you think that by this process, Turkey have made a decision maybe to kind of sacrifice the strategic partnership which she had with Israel, and how it goes with also regarding to other neighbors in the area like Iran and Syria. Thank you.
I have been critical of the Turkish government Israel policy, and when you read the papers, it's also there where the relationship with Israel is in the section where I talk about the glass half empty. I've been critical because I think Turkey should have kept this strong relationship with Israel for a number of reasons, but one of which is, if Turkey wants indeed to play the role that it wants, aspires to, of being an effective mediator of contributing to the settlement of many of the frozen conflicts in our region. One very obvious one is the Middle East peace process. And this is actually an area where, up until very recently, Turkey was very active, being a mediator between Syria and Israel. So now the consequences of this policy, the souring of the relationship with Israel, has totally sidelined Turkey as an actor in the Middle East peace process. Because now the Turkish policymakers have no ability to talk to the Israeli authorities. Now here, obviously, we can debate about, you know, whose responsibility it was. Obviously, it wasn't just on the Turkish side. There were a number of incidents on the Israeli side. And the fact that the Israeli government is a difficult government to deal with today certainly does not come in handy for the amelioration of the relationship. But nonetheless, when you look at it fundamentally, I think it's a loss for Turkish foreign policy to have lost this relationship with Israel.
Well, thank you. Peter?
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Peter Chilomushkin. I'm Washington-based correspondent for Inter-Pakistan's agency, but I'm here in my private capacity. I'm quite interested in Turkish foreign policy, and to me, it's very much, especially U.S.-Turkish relations, generally indicate the situation in the world and U.S. relations with Eurasia. You mentioned the growth of anti-Americanism in Turkey in the after the war in Iraq. My question would be about Turkish attitude to the United States under Obama administration, with Obama administration. Would you say that there is a major improvement in attitude towards the United States and Turkey while Obama is in the White House? And do you see that after Obama's visits to Turkey and all his efforts, public diplomacy efforts, the attitude of Turkish people to America became better?
Like in many parts of the world, there has been a definite change with the Obama administration. So the really ugly period is now behind us. In terms of anti-Americanism, I mean, there is certainly an improvement in Turkey's relationship with Washington. The sore point with regard to the Obama administration has been this question on the Armenian issue about the ineffectiveness or unwillingness for the Obama administration to push back the power of the Armenian lobby. And this is, you know, such a month incidentally, every year to put this as a sort of a, you know, sword over the administration of the Turkish administration. So that's really the, you know, one of the sore points. The second, but now we're over it, was with regard to Iran, where obviously there's been a disconnect in the dialogue, not only between Ankara and Washington, but also to some extent between the different entities in Washington, between the National Security Council, the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department. Somehow the message got lost. And they were, you know, and not even in translation, I think they were talking in English. Now the relationship has come, you know, has been, they've overcome that difficulty. So yes, there is an increased, there is an improvement in the perception of the U.S. in Turkey. But surprisingly, not to the degree that we have seen in Western Europe. Even when Obama was elected, his popularity ratings were never as high as they were in Western Europe. They were always significantly lower. They continue to be significantly lower. And fundamentally, one of those reasons is that the Turkish government has made no effort in its own public diplomacy to overcome this phenomenon of anti-Americans. Which is also to some extent what I can say about Europe as well. So the political rhetoric at the governmental side these past few years has been mostly either neutral or negative. They had very little positive things to say about the US and about Europe. And that reflects in the public opinion. So is it a matter of the polls driving the government or the, you know, the leadership driving the polls? I think in Turkey it's rather the leadership that's driving the polls.
Maxim Bratevsky, High School of Economics. My question is very obvious. How modern Turkey views its current and future place and role in our Caucasus?
Well, the main, of course, question in recent times in South Caucasus for Turkey, well, at least there are two issues. One is Georgia, the other one is Armenia, and incidentally Azerbaijan, of course, as a player. On Armenia, what Turkey tried to do, incidentally, was to conclude, and they concluded a series of protocols with Armenia, which unfortunately was handled badly by the Turkish government, and then also by the Armenian government. And I'll tell you why. Those protocols were negotiated between diplomats after almost 42 rounds of secret negotiations. They had the political backing of the Turkish president. But then the prime minister, and you should understand that the Turkish prime minister is somebody who is a very astute, very shrewd, very charismatic politician, which has an eye exclusively on domestic politics. And he's not somebody who inherently understands the trade-offs that may exist between foreign policy, which have to be necessarily much more long-term, and domestic policy, where the issues are very short-term and really electoral cycle indexed. So on the Armenian question, on this particular question, the protocols with Armenia, he went to Baku because he was afraid of the reaction, the nationalist reaction in Turkey, fearing that it may have cost him votes, and openly imposed a conditionality between the ratification of those protocols and the improvement, if not to say the settlement, of the Nagorno-Karabakh dispute. That was on the Turkish side. And on the Armenian side, the Armenian Constitutional Court, when they interpreted these agreements, imposed a conditionality saying that in no way the ratification of these protocols were going to change on the Armenian position, that what happened in 1915 is considered to be a genocide. So that sort of, you know, for two sides, that really eliminates all sorts of incentive that there is. From the Turkish side, obviously, you know, these protocols were meant to establish a new dialogue with Armenia, where we could openly discuss what happened around those events. But if the Armenian side is going to say, in no way our position is going to change from start one, and this is underpinned by a ruling of the Constitutional Court, then what incentive is there for Turkey anymore? Same on the Turkish side. Once Turkey imposes this conditionality with regard to Nagorno-Karabakh, then obviously it makes it more difficult for the Armenian side to ratify these protocols. So I think for both sides, from, you know, it was a grossly mismanaged initiative, a well-intentioned effort. I have been in support of it. So hopefully, perhaps after the elections, some things might change and we can refocus on this. On Georgia, the Turkish position is to be respectful of the territorial integrity of Georgia. Now, having said that, there is quite a strong, for instance, Abbas diaspora in Turkey. So at least the cultural exchanges, the visits between that region and Turkey will remain. And there's no way to prevent that. And Turkey is, because of its own diaspora, is going to have to tread a fine line between the two. At the end of the day, Georgia is also one of our neighbors. There are a number of important infrastructure projects, like the Baku-Tiflis-Ceyhan pipeline. So Turkey attaches, to maintaining good relations and, again, to maintain the territorial integrity of Georgia. So, and Azerbaijan, Azerbaijan has a particular place in Turkish politics. But they were, I think they overplayed their hand in this issue when Turkey tried to negotiate these protocols with Armenia. And that led to a backlash in Turkey against the Azeris, in the sense of, who do you think they are? Can they impose the type of veto on what we are going to do as Turkey in our relations with Armenia? So I think that led to a crisis of confidence between the two sides, with the Azeris also being frustrated at the Turks. I think for wrong reasons, because the Turkish government was, gave due attention to informing the Azeris about what was happening. They didn't share the texts, but at least, they briefed them about what was happening. So they made an effort to inform the Azeris about this. So I think the Azeri reaction was a bit overplayed. And now, today, as things stand, that process is frozen. And Turkey pins its hopes on the Minsk process and on the countries that take part, in particular in Russia. So there is a lively debate in Turkey about whether Russia actually has an interest in really fostering the settlement of the Nagorno-Karabakh question, or is playing an equivocal role, whether they are actually doing all that they can to push the Armenian government to come to terms with the Azeris on Nagorno-Karabakh. There is such a debate in Turkey now about the role of Russia.
Okay, thank you. The next question, Paul.
Yes.
And then.
Thank you very much for this sharp and very detailed briefing. I just two questions, if you don't mind. First of all, Turkey was a black sheep in the previous interactions from NATO and moving and NATO interactions in Iraq and Bosnia and Afghanistan and so on. What do you think, what would be the role of Turkey in the Libyan conflict settlement?
NATO, you mean?
No. I'm thinking of Turkey's role in the conflict settlement in Libya. What would be the role
in
of
Libya?
Turkey? Yes.
Okay.
And the second one later.
I don't particularly agree with your assessment that Turkey was a black sheep, especially.
Black sheep.
Okay.
No.
There's a small difference.
There's a small difference. Now, on Libya, again, here I will have to refer to our prime minister, who in areas of foreign policy has a tendency to be prey to his instincts, and I suppose he's not the only politician in this world to do that. But nonetheless, on Libya, what he said initially was, what business does NATO have in Libya? And that was construed abroad as official Turkish policy, and it was not. But obviously, how can you claim that this was not official policy if the prime minister says it? So that really clouded the judgment about what is it that Turkey wants to accomplish in Libya. But as the Turkish Prime Minister was saying this, at the same time, in parallel to that, NATO was already preparing its operational planning about Libya, and Turkey was in full support of that. So, and today, what happened after that statement is an indication that Turkish foreign policy was actually fully in line with NATO involvement. So much so that initially Turkey reacted strongly against the establishment of a political alliance outside of NATO, which would have the, you know, the general authority for these missions, and tried to bring it under the NATO umbrella, and successfully. Now, what Turkey tries to do in Libya is a very difficult balancing act, and I think they're not being very successful about it either. On the one hand, the Prime Minister is talking to Gaddafi and giving him the message that he should leave. On the other hand, the Foreign Minister is talking to the opposition in Benghazi and trying to create the conditions for the opposition and the Gaddafi regime to start a process of dialogue in order to reach a political settlement. So from this perspective, Turkish position is very different than the French attitude or even the UK, which have been very much clearer in their positioning within Libya, where they position themselves firmly with the opposition in Benghazi. France has, you know, even recognized that as the legitimate representative of the Libyan state. Turkey is not there. Turkey is trying to do this or to act in this way of maintaining links with the two at the same time. But at the end of the day, whether this will help Turkey to have a degree of influence in the post-conflict phase in Libya, I am uncertain. Having served in Libya, I think the tragedy of the country is that, unlike Egypt, where the international community can rely on institutions, whether it's the military in particular, obviously in Egypt, or in Tunisia, about, you know, other political movements, in Libya, Gaddafi made sure that there were absolutely no institutions apart from his own family and his own power structure. So when he's gone, there's absolutely no easy way to ensure a smooth transition in Libya. And therefore, let alone Turkey, I think we should all be humble in our approach towards Libya in trying to ascertain the position that external actors could actually play in Libya, because I tend to think that that is going to be a very minimal influence. It's going to really be up to the Libyans, and unfortunately we are set for a very troublesome period of transition in Libya.
And your second question?
Yeah. Thank you very much. And my second question, just about the EU membership. Can you describe us some details on the human rights in Turkey, especially female rights, divorce and stuff like that, if you don't mind, and especially in the countryside? Thank you.
Women's rights and human rights?
Human rights and inside female's rights.
Okay. One of the fundamental transformations in Turkey, due to a large extent to the EU process, has been the vast improvement over the human rights situation. That certainly is true when compared to 10 years ago. So today we don't speak about torture, which, you know, was existent perhaps 10 years ago. We don't speak about you know, the gross human rights violations. The problem that surfaces in Turkey today is really how as a society, are we going to create the conditions to satisfy some of the aspirations of Turkish citizens with, you know, with the Kurds, that have Kurdish origin? That is really what divides Turkish society, because on the one hand, the vision is one that's been very much influenced by, you know, the French principle of territorial integrity, but also a unified state. So Turkey is not a federal state, so transforming this particular setup is extremely difficult, and certainly there is no desire to do that. But there are aspirations among the Kurds in terms of their cultural freedom. Some of them have been met. Again, compared to 5 years ago, for instance, now it's free to broadcast in the Kurdish language, free to publish, and so on and so forth. The question that remains on the cultural side is one of education. So, namely, is the state going to allow Kurdish to be taught in state institutions as a language in primary school, for instance? That opens the door to a difficult stage where, you know, even though they may be the more numerous of those, but there are other linguistic minorities, whether they are, you know, the Circassians, whether they're the Arabs, and so on. So once you allow that to happen as a state-induced, as a state-facilitated thing, how do you respond to the demands of other constituencies that may have similar demands? So these are difficult questions which Turkish society today is trying to tackle. And fundamentally, this is also going to be one of the core issues of the next constitutional amendments, which is in the offing after the elections of the 12th of June. There is going to be, the parties have agreed that there is going to be a new constitution, and this is going to constitute one of the core elements of the new constitutional amendments, how to create an environment where these minorities will feel much more at home, much more comfortable with their setting. That is going to be the talk of the town, in a way. Now, regarding the situation of women, I am not known to be in Turkey, somebody who's very pro-government. So that's my, at least you should hear what I have to say along those lines. But nonetheless, my problem with the Turkish government is their social conservatism. And that social conservatism obviously is inimical to the role of women in Turkish society and in the labor market. Already Turkey has a very low share of labor force participation among women. It's about 24%, which is very, very low. And that's dropping even more. And the only reason why, actually there are two reasons, one which is understandable, which is the education reason, namely when you look at scholastic achievements, men have higher scholastic achievement than women. That's not. In other words, that means that the number of years of schooling attended by men is higher than women, because young girls tend to school, in Turkey at least, tend to leave school at an earlier age than young boys. So at the end, that creates a difference in terms of their own schooling years. And that has a reflection on the job market, because the job market requires additional skills. So in Turkey, a large part of the women were employed in agriculture. And as the economy is shifting from, you know, less and less agriculture-based to a more services and industrial-based, the people who get the jobs in services and industry are not the women, but those are the men. So that tends to decrease the women's labor force participation. That's to some extent understandable. If not, you know, I don't want to condone it, but at least I understand the reasons. But the reason, but the other trend, which is totally ununderstandable, is even among women who have a university degree, and here in the professional field, in the liberal professions, in the Turkish Foreign Service, for instance, there's a very high representation of women. But even among women with a university degree, their labor force participation rate has dropped by 10 percentage points over the past 10 years, from 80% to 70%. And here there's absolutely no explanation apart from growing social conservatism.
Sir?
My name is Dmitry Konkov. I'm from Center for Energy and Security Studies. Mr. Ulbian, thank you for your presentation and for your answers. And my question is following. During the past month, after the Fukushima tragedy, we heard, I mean, my colleagues related to the nuclear energy field, we heard in different places of the world, Washington, Berlin, and here in Moscow, that the plans to develop nuclear energy in Turkey might be revised, especially in relation to four blocks of Akkuyu nuclear power plant, which are to be constructed by Rosatom. Mm-hmm. So I would appreciate if you would comment on the following questions. What was the real impact of Fukushima tragedy on public opinion about nuclear energy development in Turkey? And if there were concerns about Akkuyu power plant, what were the reasons for such an attitude? Seismicity or, you know, lack of security of nuclear energy at all? And could the rise of such an anti-nuclear public attitude be caused by upcoming elections in your country? Thank you very much.
One thing that where I'll have to disagree is that, unlike the rest of the world, in Turkey, the government position remains very solid. And the government reiterated that no matter what, Turkey is going to go ahead with nuclear energy and with this particular project in Akkuyu with Rosatom. So the government's position has not changed. What has changed is the public opinion stance on nuclear energy. And that's understandable, in a way. When you look at what happened in Japan, which is a country that has a certain safety and security culture, that if nuclear energy can fail so disastrously in Japan, of course you can say it's a tsunami, it's, you know, it's an act of God and so on, but nonetheless, you know, if it can fail so disastrously, so I think it's understandable that in a democratic society there would be some second thoughts about nuclear energy. I don't find the government's approach to be particularly constructive. The reason is the government is so assertive that it gives the impression that it is turning a blind eye to the risks of nuclear energy, even after Fukushima. I think the government position should have been, we want to have nuclear energy in our portfolio, and, you know, we have the agreement with Russia, we want to proceed with that, but we also want to draw the right lessons from Fukushima. So we want to make sure that the right lessons have been drawn, the right institutional setup has been established, the right safety and security regulations are in place, so on and so forth. Instead of giving this message that could have satisfied the concerns of the Turkish public opinion, the Prime Minister said, oh, what's the difference? Don't you put a Aygaz Tüpü, how do you translate that? You know, in Turkey for heating in kitchen, you put these LPG, you know, these LPG bottles. So what's the difference? You hook up your LPG bottle in the kitchen and nuclear energy. So why you should be concerned about this? That was the analogy that he drew. And of course, you know, this even made things more problematic. Now the opposition party is asking for a referendum, for instance, on nuclear energy. And therefore it has been politicized. And I think the government lost an opportunity to address intelligently the concerns that have emerged in Turkish society about nuclear energy after Japan. That's why I think the government's approach has been counterproductive. Now, what are the concerns? Well, the concerns are, you know, the more widespread concerns about the safety of nuclear energy, but in particular in Turkey, it's because it is claimed that Akkuyu is near a seismic line, that that region was earmarked for nuclear plant back in 1976, and there hasn't been any update on the seismic situation in the region since 1976, but also because of the fact that Turks are not confident that the state can really establish the type of structures necessary to deal with the safety and security issues surrounding nuclear power. So to have the type of human resources policy, to have a fully independent regulator, and so on and so forth. And again, the government doesn't do anything productive to address those concerns. So these are, I think, some of the issues. In terms of the anti-nuclear lobby, we don't particularly have a very strong anti-nuclear lobby in Turkey. For instance, when you compare to Western Europe, there is not even a lobby in Turkey that lobbies for the removal of, you know, tactical nuclear weapons, unlike what you see in Germany and so on. But there is an emerging, indeed, lobby against nuclear power, and now it's been politicized. As I said, with the government, with the opposition party asking for a referendum on whether to switch to nuclear power, it has become a very politicized issue.
Okay, the lady
in
white, followed by
I want to ask you about the Turkish position concerning the Shanghai Organization of Cooperation. Doesn't Turkey think to join as a supervisor?
I think we are already part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as an observer, if I'm not mistaken. Do you know? No, we're not. Okay, we're not. Sorry, I'm mistaken.
We're all observers.
Yeah.
Supervisors.
I'm sorry, I can't answer your question. I don't have enough information about what our position. Yeah, as an observer, we're not, I mean...
There's a dialogue partnership regarding the Shanghai Cooperation, and a different partnership.
Okay. I'm sorry, that's not a question that I'm, you know, I have enough information about. But, so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Evgeny Stanovsky, the president of Moscow Institute for the Near Eastern Studies. And I have three brief and easy questions because I usually specialize in easy questions. Number one, this September, Palestinians and United Nations put on the table of the world community the question about the Palestinian state and the borders of 1967. What's the Turkish position will be in this moment? Number two, the moment when official Erbil will say that this is the independent state of Kurdish nation, which was promised by the League of Nations, which will be very soon. What will be Turkish position? And number three, 2 or 4 years up to now, when Iranians will finish their program with the nuclear bomb, what will
And can I have your difficult...
I should have warned you, Sinan. Yevgeny specializes in very, very simple questions. I'm sorry I didn't warn you beforehand, but anyway.
And can I have your difficult questions? These were the easy ones, right?
The questions are easy. He expects the answers to be in.
On the Palestinian issue, Turkey actually made an effort and continues to make an effort along the lines of, you know, the Oslo Agreement. So this is Turkey's position, and there, what the role that Turkey can play is, you know, to some extent, I've addressed the question of the Israeli dimension. But the role that Turkey tries to play at least is to bring about a unified front on the Palestinian side. So talking both to Fatah and Hamas, so that the Israeli side could have an interlocutor to advance this process on the one hand. And secondly, it's also lobbying with the United States government to not to put this on the back burner. Under current circumstances, but we should, the international community should keep this as a part of their most priority agenda. Now, on whether a Kurdish state will emerge, it may not, but certainly even if it does, it won't be because of the League of Nations. Now, looking at the recent developments in the region, there has been a radical change in Turkish policy in 2007. And again, as opposed to viewing this region as a security threat, Turkish foreign policy has now changed and views this as a region of opportunity. And there's been an engagement with the Kurdish regional leadership. So there's now a very strong dialogue with most of them. That region has become part of Turkey's economic hinterland. When you go there, I'm sure you will have witnessed it. Most of the, you know, the large majority of the both infrastructure and superstructure, so the roads, but also the hospitals, the schools, the universities are built by Turkish contractors. A Turkish company has also invested in the oil business there and is now started to export oil. So fundamentally, the parameters of Turkey's relationship have changed. When you hear some of the regional leaders talking about it, they are asking, some of them, because they don't see a future in Iraq, they're asking not for an independent Kurdistan, as you phrased it, but they're asking about ways that they could, you know, form or be part of Turkey. That is what has become more pressing for them. But obviously the Turkish position is try to bring the solutions, the framework for Iraq to stay together as a single state. And, you know, whether that can happen or not is still an open question. But I think there will be a lot of political capital invested in this after the U.S. troops leave definitely. On Iran, Turkish position is strategically very similar to the one of the West and the one in Russia. Namely, Turkey does not want to see the emergence of a nuclear-armed Iran, and rightly so, because one of the countries that will be most affected by such a development will be Turkey. It's not so much that Turks feel that there is a threat emanating from Iran directly, but because if the specter of a nuclear-armed Iran might lead to a domino effect with additional countries seeking nuclear armaments, if not by building a concealed nuclear program or even by, you know, wholesale purchase of nuclear weapons, And two, the regional stability. You know, if there is an increased tension between Iran and Israel, what's going to happen to the region? So for a host of, and thirdly, of course, because you know, Iran can then adopt a much more aggressive stance in its foreign policy. And Turkey historically is a country that has had good relations with Israel, with Iran, with Israel as well, hopefully one day, but with Iran for you know, four centuries. I am told, I don't have the means to check, but the Turkish-Iranian border is the longest standing unchanged border in the world. So that means something in this turbulent region. But on the other hand, these are countries that traditionally, historically, and to this day, continue to be rivals. We see this rivalry illustrated most vividly in Iraq, where the two sides lobbied for different candidates. Malaki won at the end of the day, which was rather the Iranian candidate. We see that in Lebanon. We see that in Syria. So across this geography, Turkey and Iran are actually in political competition, and that's part of our joint history. So from those perspectives, Turkey would certainly be very uncomfortable with the talk of a nuclear Iran. Now, if one day indeed Iran becomes a nuclear power, then Turkish position would be to be part of the strategy of containing Iran. I don't see any other choice for the Turkish authorities. And when I hear analysis made to claim that Turkey would then, as a reaction, develop its own nuclear weapons program, I certainly don't agree with that. Turkey is is a NATO member. It's open. It has this military cooperation. And there's no reason for a change. And it's impossible for a NATO country to have a concealed nuclear program, obviously.
Thank you. Let me use my own privilege and ask Sinan a question of my own. In your paper, and also in the talk today, you did refer to President Ozal and Foreign Minister Çim in the previous political period in Turkey, but you very clearly linked this new foreign policy, and it's broader than just new foreign policy. It's in many ways, as you said yourself, it's a new Turkey that's emerged. It has emerged under the auspices of the AK Party. Now, you also said there's going to be an election in June, and my friends among the Moscow Turkologist community assure me that there's unlikely to be a major change in Turkish politics as a result of this election. But it's still a policy very much conceptualized and articulated and implemented by one party. Now the question is, how far does it spread in the Turkish political establishment beyond the AK Party? What aspects maybe, I know it's a very hypothetical question, but if you look ahead, if you refer to Turkey as a democracy, and I would subscribe to that, which means that at some point we may anticipate a change of government in Turkey. And if that's the case, then what are the implications for Turkey's foreign policy? How far is what you have been describing as new Turkey, as Turkey's new foreign policy, is becoming more of a consensual issue? And whether foreign policy could become, at least within the elite circles, a battleground for different ideas, different priorities, and eventually different policies.
Let me just perhaps take a few moments to address the domestic situation, because even though my belief was up until perhaps a month ago that the outcome of the elections were clear, that AKP would win, today things start to look slightly different. It's still likely that AKP, very likely that AKP will win the elections. But the question is whether they will have enough seats in parliament to establish the new government single-handedly is becoming more uncertain. It is becoming more uncertain because of the latest troubles that we have seen emerging regarding the freedom of association and press freedoms in Turkey, with the journalists being taken to prison, a scandal about the university entrance exams. So a number of things that have started to hurt the government. So that question is not as clear-cut as it was a month ago, I would tend to claim. But let's go beyond that and answer your question. When you talk to the representatives of the opposition party about what is it that they would change in Turkish foreign policy, the answer that you get is A, there would be a change at the level of rhetoric. Namely, you would not have this inflammatory rhetoric about the West, about Europe, possibly about Israel, if there's a change in the leadership. Because that rhetoric lately has been quite inflammatory, certainly with regard to Israel, but also with regard to Europe. A week ago, the Prime Minister went to the Council of Europe at the Parliamentary Assembly, and he delivered a speech, you know, as if Turkey was not a member of the Council of Europe and the Parliamentary Assembly, which, by the way, Turkey holds the presidency. So what they tell you is that, firstly, at the level of rhetoric, Turkey would be much more stable. And not seek to polarize the situation in its foreign relations to take an advantage in domestic politics. Secondly, I think that things will change with regard to Israel as well. Because on Israel, even though, again, it's not only the Turkish government that is to blame, obviously a lot of the blame has to do with the Israeli government as well in the souring of the relationship. Nonetheless, we, with a different government, we would not have had the same type of inflammatory rhetoric with regard to Israel. So that is the second thing that they point out when you talk to them about what is going to change. The third thing that, again, according to them, is likely to change is that there is going to be more emphasis on the EU aspect. Because their claim is that this government is actually not interested in Turkey's EU accession, that they have instrumentalized this for their own domestic purposes, for sidelining the military, for instance, and for other things, but they're not fundamentally interested in Turkish accession. So they claim, the opposition claims, that this is also something that they will change, that they will push the, you know, a word that you know well here, the reset button, with regard to the EU, and try to build the confidence, pass the legislation, and so on and so forth, to build momentum in the Turkey-EU relationship. And fourthly, the fundamental change that they claim they will introduce is a much more focused on multilateralism, because they claim that this government has a very unilateral policy, that they like to portray themselves as, you know, Turkey being this pivotal state, as the actor that can do it. And therefore they go and do it, or try to do it, without bothering really to consult with some of our partners, including Russia perhaps, in some of the issues facing us. So their criticism is along these lines, that if they were in power, Turkish foreign policy would be much more multilateral, a bit like change from, you know, Bush to Obama, and trying to act in partnership with our allies. Those are really the issues that they underline.
Thank you, Sinan. Any more questions or comments or... There's one, and there's another one, and there's another one. So we take the three questions together, and then we'll turn them over to Dr. Ugin. Please.
Hello, my name is Mariano Pig. I'm a Spanish embassy, and I discussed a big question about the South Stream and the final, if it is a predictable position of Turkey regarding this point.
Well, I'm not in the government, so I can't tell you with a degree of certainty what Turkey's reaction will be. But I think as things stand, when the two leaders have met, they reached an agreement whereby Turkey gave its green light for the Russian side to undertake the feasibility study. That feasibility study was handed over to the Turkish authorities. Turkish authorities had a set of additional questions, and now they're awaiting the answer to those set of additional questions. After they get that additional, the answer to that set of additional questions, then we shall enter the phase of assessment. And there has been given, the government gave no indication about the outcome of that assessment. So Turkey has, to this day, to my knowledge, has not adopted an attitude, a clear attitude about the outcome of South Stream. So that's uncertain, open-ended. It may be that eventually the Turkish government will say yes. It may be that the Turkish government will say no. That is unclear yet. There's no official position on that. The official position, again, is, you know, we have just asked for a set of additional analysis. Let's get those, and then we'll see.
Thank you.
So thank you for your brilliant presentation. Oleg Kulikov from Moscow Defense University. Among Russian military experts, there is a conjecture that in case Georgia becomes a member of NATO, Turkey will lose its monopoly in the region to pursue policy on behalf of NATO, so being so the regional power. What will be the position of Turkey if Georgia becomes a member of NATO in regard of that I have just said? Good problem. Thank you.
Well, I think that was a question that preoccupied us. I think us here, I mean both the policy people, but also people like me. But I think that's totally, it's now totally gone. Nobody today really gives a realistic chance of Georgia joining NATO anytime soon. So we've stopped worrying about that. And you may have noticed in 2008, already Turkey was not, you know, at some point it was a prospect pushed very much by the neocons. But today, again, it's not even on the agenda. We don't lose sleep over it. And in 2008, in August, what Turkey did was, you will recall that at the time when Russia intervened and the US wanted to send some military ships, Turkey did apply the Montreux Convention fully, which led to a very negative statements from Washington about whether we were, you know, we were thinking along the same lines. So again, here you see that there's a thinking that, you know, things that happen in this neighborhood should essentially be of concern to the regional states, without, in particular, the intervention of outside actors. But going back to your first statement, you know, that analysis is not even undertaken anymore because Georgia's NATO membership is for the time being a lost cause, and there's no imminence in that.
Thank you. That should be reassuring, right? The final question goes somewhere here, right, if I'm not mistaken? No? And then I was mistaken. But I will not be mistaken to say that we've just had a brilliant expose of the issues in the foreign policy of a very important and increasingly more important country. And I'm sure that there's no better person to explain it, especially to foreign audiences, than my colleague Sinan Ilgen. And I would wish that he were able to come here in the future, and we hope to have more difficult questions for him when he comes back. But right now, please join me in a warm round of applause and thanks to Sinan Ilgen. Thank you.